Welcome to True Crime in the Low Country, where we explore the darkest corners of the region's criminal history. Join host Frank Santarella and co-hosts Crime and Cask, Jim Cask, and Elaine Greenwood of Superwoke News as they dissect the chilling details of the Murdaugh murder trial, a case that has gripped the nation and exposed years of fraud, deception, and tragedy. It's true crime in the Low Country, and the truth is just around the corner.
Yep. How you doing, folks? This is Frank on Target, and we're doing true crime in the Low Country, and I'm here with the illustrious Elaine Greenwood of Super Woke News and Jim Cask of Crime and Cask. Crime and Cask?
Crime and Cask.
Crime and Cask. Now, you know, I know both of these folks for a long time, and I still can't get my introduction right. I trip over my tongue. But we got these guys here.
You're getting close.
Listen, by the time I meet my demise, I'll have it down pat. But anyway, we're going to talk about Jim's book, the one that just came out. Is that what we're talking about this morning?
Yep.
Yes.
All right, Jim, tell us, give us the title, tell us where we can get it, that's it.
Yeah. So, listen, if you were interested at all, in the Alex Murdaugh trial, and you all remember Juror 785, better known as the Egg Lady, she wrote a book. She's an author of a new book that I help her write. It's called Because Enough is Enough. It's a tell-all book on how Juror 785, her name now, by the way, she's come out publicly on Fox News and Fox Nation and Inside Edition and the New York Post and everywhere else. Her name is Myra Crosby. And how Myra was wrongly kicked off the jury at the Alex Murdaugh trial. It is available on Amazon right now. And I will tell you, the country is wanting to know what happened to her. That book went on sale, and in less than 24 hours, it went to number 8 on Amazon's true crime, white-collar crime category, which is unheard of because Valerie Burline's book, Devil's Elbow, which is a New York Times bestseller, is number 1 and number 2 in paperback and hard copy, hardcover. So for us to go to number 8 along with that book, which is a New York Times bestseller, it is a hot seller on Amazon, I suggest you.
Now, Jim, explain to the audience that Valerie's book shipped number 1 on the New York Times bestseller. And that's a statistic related to how many books shipped, not how many books were sold. Well, your statistic is actually based on how many books you sold, because you're not shipping any. So it's a different statistic. Your statistic is a more accurate sense of what people actually want to read versus Valerie having a lot of books shipped.
Yeah, nothing against Valerie's book. I'm sure it's a fine book. I haven't read it yet. Hers was a New York Times bestseller within 2 weeks, I think, of its launch. But anyways, in less than 24 hours, it went to number 8, which I was quite happy with. So it's available on Amazon, exclusively on Amazon right now. You can order it and get it. I tried doing the test on that. I ordered it and I'm getting it in 2 days. So
all right.
I know people that ordered it and got it the next day, so that's where it's available.
All right, come on. I want to make his laugh. I'm going to give you, before we get into Jim's book, I'm going to give you a little chuckle.
Okay.
I guess both of you guys know that my undergraduate degree is in media. Now, I got to tell you, there's the manipulation of the media that we see today. They were teaching us that, and I graduated college in 1973. All right. About bestsellers, I had a few authors that were professors or ad hocs, whatever the case was. And, they were teaching us how to establish a bestseller book. All right. Now, Amazon, remember when Amazon was only brick and mortar stores? You guys remember that?
No, thought it was old. Oh, no.
It wasn't. It was Barnes and Noble. Barnes and Noble. Right. It wasn't Amazon. Barnes and Noble was brick and mortar stores. And I lived in proximity of New York City. And they were telling us that there were authors. Now, and Jim, you self-published, right? So you weren't dealing with a publisher. But what they do is the publishing house will give you 500 books, 500 books for your own distribution, and then they'll go out into distribution through their regular networks. So what he was saying was that if you're going to publish a book and go through a publisher and they offer you those 500 books or 200 books or whatever they are, don't take them. Go to Barnes and Noble and buy everything they have on the shelf, all right? And then go to the second Barnes and Noble and buy everything they have on the shelf, and you will go to the bestseller list. That's what the...
Sure, or like with Harry's book, Spare, the publishing house, which supposedly is in deep financial trouble for doing this because they couldn't afford to do it, but they would ship two books for every one that was ordered. So people were saying, hey, all over the world were saying, Lady Colin Campbell said, hey, you know, just like a lot of other people in my audience of hundreds of thousands, I got two books. I only ordered one. And, but they also determined that people weren't reading it, but they did ship a lot of books. And, you know, we're gullible as a public, and so we do buy that. But, Jim, tell us what are the important, because we only talked for about an hour or so. So what's the important takeaway from the book that you want the audience to know? Let's start with that.
The number one is, you know, and I think the title really captures the essence of this book. And the title is called Because Enough is Enough. And I think that really hits home for Myra, because she had songs about her. She had podcasters, media talking about how she talked. She talked to her tenants, the fake Facebook page. With the ex-husband, there was so much controversy and really unknown information surrounding the removal of her. And
there was more than controversy. There was the allegation that she had violated an oath, basically, that she had taken in Newman's court, that she would not discuss the case outside of the jury. So this was a defamatory allegation that she had done that.
Correct.
Yeah,
and so this was her having enough. This was it. She's like, I've had enough. I've listened to this enough. I am going to set the record straight. Now, she had her anonymity. It was by a court order so that, you know, no one could mention her name, contact her, bother her, all these things. So why come out is the question. And then I asked her that. I'm like, why are you coming out? And she says, really, because enough is enough. I've had it. Not only have I had it with the accusations, false accusations about me, Myra, I've also had it with people not giving Alex Murdaugh what every single United States citizen should demand, they should have, and that is the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. And in her opinion, she believes he was not granted that fair trial by the Sixth Amendment, granted by our founding fathers, that this...
Actually, it was amended, not by our founding fathers, but yes, you're right. We have a right to a fair trial. Can I ask you, what came first, the desire to do the book or a Fox special about her story? Was the Fox special, which I have not seen, was that in the works before this book was in the works, or was the Fox... coverage related to their knowledge that she was writing the book? How did that come about? What was the sequence?
Sure. So if you go to Fox Nation, has a channel, it's a streaming channel, where you can see an interview with her and Martha McCallum and Joe McCullough and Mandy Pierce, who is Juror Z, and Myra Crosby, who is Juror 785. The book was finished when we approached Fox. So the book was done. It was Fox who was very wonderful people to work with. They're really into the Murdaugh saga. They have a whole online presence on it on Fox Nation. So go and watch her talk and watch Mandy talk and their attorney exactly what happened. But it was the book came first. She contacted me months ago. It was prior to me even having radiation where she had contacted me and out of the blue. And I was actually, I was with a friend of mine having a drink and I said, wow, I didn't even believe it. I was like, and Alex Roger just sent me a message. Mm-hmm. And I did some checking and sure enough.
So that's important for the audience to understand that this, she did not write this in response to somebody covering the story and she just wanted to sort of get it out there. She really truly wanted to get this out there and had contacted you before anything else came up. Was Joe McCullough, did he participate in writing the book at all?
Joe McCullough, no. Although there is some documents that Joe supplied.
Transcript of the hearing that he supplied, it looks like, and things toward the end of the book, you see that.
Documents, but that, no, he didn't help in writing it, but he was, he provided an email that he sent to Creighton Waters and Dick Harpootlian and those type of things, which were very valuable.
Okay. And when she hired him to represent her, this was before she envisioned doing a book, as I understand it, but correct me if that's not true. But what was her purpose in having him represent her? Because I can see now where she has a viable cause of action here, and we could talk about that in a bit. But so now he certainly should be representing her. But what was her original purpose in having him represent her? And by the way, so the audience knows, full disclosure, he represents Juror 630 and he represents Juror 241. Is that correct? And Juror 241 is Holly. What in the heck is her name? What is Juror 241's name? Holly.
I don't know.
Yes, you do.
I don't.
All right, Elaine. Elaine, explain to us what the significance of those two other jurors is.
There are three. The three jurors that are brave enough or courageous enough to speak out about jury tampering, about what Becky Hill was doing. And one thing that I think the audience might want to know is Joe McCullough represents all three of them. And Juror 630 is Juror Z, and that might be Mandy Pierce. And I'm thinking the other one.
That is Mandy Pierce, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so Juror 241 is this girl, Holly. Because I like to write this stuff down. But what's important is all the other jurors are actually represented, or most of the other jurors are represented by
Eric Bland.
Yeah, and Eric Bland has a huge conflict of interest.
All right, let's and listen,
Her name, I just found her name. Her name is Holly Miller.
All right,
is the jury foreman and the clerk of the court. But what comes out in Lila's book is the jury foreman was actually a good friend of Becky's.
All right, but who was the one that should have tore the cell phones out of their hands when he said no cell phones and they were on the cell phones? Who would
bailiff.
Probably the bailiff.
The bailiff works under the clerk of court.
I think, Frank, you know that answer better than we do. I believe he does. But what happens is there are, in a system where there's jury tampering, the evidence of it or somebody coming forward to discuss it, it could come from different official sources that complain of it. It could be from a juror complaining, and it could be from another officer of the court. But when it is known, it is the duty of an officer of the court or an employee of the state, an extension of the state, to come forward with that information because it's grounds for a mistrial. And what happened here is clearly Newman had grounds for a mistrial. And
numerous times,
not once. You can go and find me on Rumble and I call him Boob Newman, and I was very critical of him not declaring a mistrial when it was clear even from the in-camera transcripts that we had that he had enough information to know what Becky was doing needed a much fuller examination because she was in fact tampering with this juror, at least, at a minimum. And it wouldn't have taken much to figure out that she was acting in collusion with people that were directly tied to Mark Tinsley and Eric Bland, who had direct ties to Peyton Waters. So there was enough there to say, this is a mistrial. And Alec does deserve, I don't know whether he's innocent or guilty, but it's not relevant what I think about this guilt or innocence. It's what's relevant is he have a fair trial. We all have an interest in that. And so I don't know how far up the food chain it goes. After reading Myra's book, I don't think it went much up the food chain at all. I think it is what I always thought it was, which is just a determined effort by Mark Tinsley, Eric Bland, and others to have this narrative. They had an enormous financial incentive to push a narrative. They certainly did. And our gullible, just incredibly inept media said, hey, this is really lucrative. And, you know, a lot of them made content where their sources were Mark Tinsley and Eric Bland, because they would always take your phone call. If you were with media, they would take your phone call and give you a quote. And so you were safe to publish their view of this. And media just fell down. They did a horrible job actually covering this story. So, you know, you've talked about this before. Move this trial to a different venue. Get an impartial jury. One of the other things Myra talks about is how distracting the financial evidence was. It's irrelevant to who killed Paul and Maggie. It's not evidence of a motive, I don't believe. It's enormous prejudicial value doesn't outweigh its probative value, so it should never have been allowed in. It would be a much shorter trial. Let's see what the state actually has as evidence. And if they have evidence to convict him, let's convict him. I agree with something else Myra says. What are you afraid of? If the evidence was good, if the case was sound, you have no choice but to grant a second trial. Go ahead and do it. Stop whinging and whining and moaning about it and spinning around in circles and acting like idiots. Just go ahead. Do the second trial, because it matters to all of us. Our constitutional rights matter to all of us. But right. Jim, there are more revelations that come out of the book, so you might want to keep going with that.
Well, for an example, when you talk about Eric Bland, attorney Eric Bland, who represented the Satterfield, he represents for pro bono, he represents six of the remaining jurors on the...
And how did he get to represent the Satterfields? He got the referral from Mark Tinsley.
Mark Tinsley, yeah. But on February 28th of 2023, during the trial, on another YouTube show, Eric Bland goes on and says, on the 28th, by the way, so she has not even been released from the jury yet, which was on March 2nd. Yes. Eric Bland goes on to say he knows about a note sent to the judge about the juror making a comment. Now, they don't say what juror, but as you know, Eric Bland is part of Cup of Justice, and Cup of Justice doxed all the jurors at the beginning of the trial. One of them being Myra, who referred to her as, you know, working at the monkey farm. But how did Eric Bland know on the 28th that information was with the prosecution, with the defense, and with the judge in camera, in judge's chambers?
Right.
You want to tell me how that gets released to Eric Bland?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, hold on. No, wait. Didn't Eric Bland say he was in daily contact with one of the prosecutors from the state?
I think he brags about that, or I think they took a lot of pictures together. They should not have allowed Eric Bland or Mark Tinsley within 1,000 miles of the prosecution table or that trial, because they had a vested interest and insurmountable conflict of interest because of those civil lawsuits. And yet, that was just a mistake with the prosecution.
Well, why is Eric Bland giving the prosecution questions? I think he even said strategy. Like, he's a civil attorney. He's a civil attorney that sues other attorneys.
Didn't start at trial. Anybody covering this case who'd actually covered it would have noticed in October, I think October 7th of 2021, at the original bond hearing on just the allegations up to, you know, right after the suicide attempt, right before Newman. It was the first time Alec is before Newman, and he reasonably expects he's going to be granted bail. You listen to what Eric Bland addressed the court, and you listen, and my first thought was, he's either plagiarizing Mandy Matney, or she's been plagiarizing him. She and Fitz News have been plagiarizing him, because they're singing from the same hymn book. It's almost verbatim what he's saying and what they've been publishing.
Right.
So I saw that right away.
Guys, try and hold your thoughts, because I'm a constant source of questions.
Eric Bland. Eric Bland is representing the nine other jurors, correct?
Yes.
All right.
Well, we think so, pretty
well,
much.
Well, all right,
I,
all right. But let's
I,
say,
I believe so.
Why? I mean, listen, I have an attorney on retainer. All right, that's I do. But why would these nine other jurors find the necessity to have an attorney? What is the standing? Is there any standing?
Because, yes, because if it's exposed what they were doing, they could actually face some kind of, I don't know if it would be criminal consequences, but there might be civil consequences because they were utterly deficient in doing what the court specifically ordered them to do, which included not discussing the case, period, including
so
not
so there is,
the case
that's,
with each other.
They may be... So, that's why they have.
So they had to script and orchestrate what they were going to say to Toll to avoid any accountability for them doing this. Because you see, when you conspire to do bad things, it can turn around and slap you in the face. And so they needed attorneys to they needed an attorney. They needed legal counsel. Eric Bland apparently did this. It's rumored he did it for free.
He said he did it for free.
So he said it. I'm trying to sort of equivocate there, to be honest, because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make a lot of clear affirmative statements that we end up getting sued over, basically. But anyhow,
So the genesis of that, by the way, is Dick Harpootlian on the courthouse steps of the South Carolina Appeals Court. Remember when him and Jim went up there? They talked about the they filed a motion to stay the appeal
on September 5th.
Correct. So I was there. I was recording that on my TikTok at Crime and Cask on TikTok. And Dick said at the time, he's like, if somebody asked a question about the other jurors, and I think he made a comment of something to the effect of, if I was the other jurors, I would, you know, get myself an attorney. And the next day, Eric Bland says, well, Dick says they need to get an attorney. Well, guess what? They got one, and I'm it. I have six of the jurors, and I'm doing a pro bono and this and that.
But it was a conflict of interest for him to represent them because he has a vested interest in them not exposing. Not blow up in his face because it will blow up the narrative. They make a lot of money on that that Discord podcast. You know, Les Akers and I were talking about it's very lucrative what they're doing. Because they put their content behind this paywall. In fact, if we wanted to put this content behind a paywall, we could all get rich and, you know, boat around with a drink in our hand without any life jackets on in the Lowcountry. And I'm going to get myself a Bering Explorer yacht to do that.
Wait a minute. Forget about the Bering Explorer yacht. I do that now.
I don't want it.
All right. Now, question. Here's one other disturbing question. Interrupting question so much. Somebody exposed Myra Crosby as to working at a monkey farm. Is that right?
Liz Farrell had this spreadsheet, and we did a five.
What monkey does? And does anybody know what monkey farm that is?
Yeah, there's only apparently one. Yes, they knew exactly which one. It's in. How do you pronounce it?
Yemisi.
It's called the Alpha Genesis Primate Research Center.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they knew who she was. And then, but, you know, nothing under cross-examination, because Toll is horrible at cross-examining Becky, absolutely wretched. And there's some verbatim quotes of hers. Those aren't the quotes I would have used from the transcript of that hearing. But my takeaway from that hearing, which we actually broadcast, we live streamed, is that Toll was horrible at allowing Becky to get away with these evasive lies one after another, but finally Toll did say, basically, you've just perjured yourself and you're not credible, basically. But still, she said, but I'm not allowing Myra. At that point, the credibility of what Becky Hill is saying is an issue before the court. And in a pre-hearing motion, Toll had said, you cannot introduce any of the evidence that basically Myra has. I will not allow it to be.
Because she was a non-voting juror.
Than that, there's a precedent that you cannot ask jurors about why they deliberated, basically. So that was sort of questionable, but kind of borderline the most credible ruling Toll made. But the minute it became an issue to refute testimony that Becky Hill had given, Myra was incredibly relevant and should have been allowed to testify at that point, simply to refute what Becky Hill had just said on the, you know, on the stand. So Toll erred in not allowing that to be explored. Toll's hearing was every bit the travesty of our judicial process that we all saw at the time, which is why we had that sinking feeling that we're going to have, that definitely there should be this second trial, but we're going to have to wait while this winds its way through the court. And I don't think that Myra has a clear understanding of the judicial process at all, but she does definitely have genuine outrage about what Toll did, which is something that everybody, it resonates with everyone. You may not respect why Toll did it, and I absolutely don't respect why Toll did it, but it outrages you just the same. It truly does. And one takeaway, I think, that from this book, and I, you know, Seton Tucker did an interview with Myra for Impact of Justice, Seton Tucker and Matt Harris. And at some point reading Jim's book last night, I said, I want to hear Impact of Influence. What did I call it? Yes, Impact of Justice. Oh, yeah, sorry, Impact of Influence. You're right. Anyway, so I'm reading Jim's book. I'm about on page 180. And by then, I'm just swearing. I'm using all the profanity I know. But for not for the same reason.
You're on the page number? That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I've got page numbers and everything, Jim. But I started out, you know, I was 20 pages into it, and I've been calling Jim last night. I'm calling him every 2 seconds, and I'm just furious. I'm furious at what Liz Farrell did as part of Cup of Justice to create that spreadsheet which doxed all of the jurors, and whether she can be held accountable for that. The rules of professional conduct say that Eric Bland, who is a partner, I believe, in this Cup of Justice enterprise, he certainly knew that this is a violation of the rules of professional conduct for him to be part of doxing all of these jurors. It was incredibly unethical, incredibly poor judgment, and I think reason for him to be disbarred. And I say that, I'll repeat it. I think that that constituted reason for him to be disbarred. That
oh,
he was
thank God you clarified that.
I appreciate that. Yes.
Because, yes, you're personally liable now. Okay.
I sure am, yes. Okay, and so, but you just broke my train of thought there, you little rascal. So what am I saying? I don't remember. So I talked to Seton Tucker, and I said, I watched the interview with Seton, and I'm very impressed. And I talked to Seton just a few minutes ago, just before we went live, and asked her about it. She has the same impression that Myra is very credible, very credible. There is one discrepancy, and it's annoying that she said it, and here's something, it's a theme throughout the book. What you have is people that don't listen to the question they're asked, and then they answer it, and then they expect to be able to turn around and say, oh, wait, I want to do over, I didn't mean it. So you have the tenant saying, we didn't mean that, we signed an affidavit. And the book describes things sometimes as in writing. In writing is who cares? I could write it. My grocery list is in writing. It has no weight in a court of law. But an affidavit is a statement made under penalty of perjury that has tremendous weight in a court of law. It's evidence. It's testimony. So when somebody signs an affidavit, they ought to make sure that they know what they're signing. So these tenants say, oh, we just signed this because we wanted to get, we've been OBU held in basically in custody from 9 to 6 p.m., and we just can't stand that, so we just signed anything that we didn't bother to read.
No, hold on, back up. What was said was, they said, we were told, sign this, it's what you told us last night. And in
you
their,
don't sign it, something you didn't I, read.
Listen,
it's an affidavit.
Listen,
I'm sorry, I'm not...
No, stop. You've got to give these people a break. They weren't given the opportunity to call any attorney to have them look at this. You had SLED agents. By the way, who sent SLED agents out to their house? Who sent SLED agents that said, you have to be in court the next day? Who drew up that affidavit? And who made that affidavit? Because what they said after they...
Well, your book mentions who you think it was, and that's something that I do think there should be a hearing about.
Isn't that a matter of record? Isn't that a matter of record?
Stay with us on True Crime in the Lowcountry. We'll be right back after this short commercial break. Don't go away.